History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. Do they have to remain untold? No, not as long as we're willing to do something about it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. It's Easter weekend, and that's going to be the theme behind our program this week. But before we hear some of the ways young Americans experienced the final Easter week of World War II, I want to draw your attention to something else that took place this past week, a relatively young holiday that seems to take on greater impact and certainly creates greater awareness each and every year. National Vietnam War Veterans Day fell on Good Friday this year because it takes place every year on March 29th. It is so heartwarming to see the contrast in how men and women who served during that era are being treated now compared to the reception they received when they returned from Vietnam. There's a pretty good chance that there are Vietnam veterans in your life, so if you haven't taken the time to send a simple thank you their way this week, now would be a good time for that. And why not put that on your calendar for next year, March 29th, 2025, and make it a point to connect with a Vietnam War Veterans Day event in your area next year. We've heard quite a few Easter Sunday stories from World War II veterans over the years here on Hometown Heroes, and perspective is a powerful thing. If you celebrate Easter and you're gathering with your family this weekend, maybe hearing how a few young Americans spent Easter in combat in 1945 will give you even more gratitude for the blessing of sharing a good meal with loved ones in 2024. The Battle of Okinawa began on Easter Sunday, April 1st, 1945. We've heard from Marines and members of the Army with some powerful experiences on that initial day of what would become a brutal battle. But it was a true nightmare for those aboard ship that first day and the days that followed because of the relentless intensity of kamikaze attacks. We're going to hear just a couple of first-hand accounts of that, starting with the memories of Benny Noonkester, who was a 17-year-old in charge of the Commodore's barge on the attack transport USS Chilton.
I looked up and here come a plane down, straight down, not on an angle, and got a destroyer right near us and killed nearly everybody on there. And it didn't actually sink, but I don't know why it didn't. And that was my experience the first day.
So first day of the battle, you see a kamikaze take out a destroyer, and that kind of says, uh-oh.
Yeah, it did. Then after that was every day. We had 44 separate attacks in one day. One time there was like 400 planes come in one time. All in 53 days, day and night.
So that's pretty much a constant fear that this could happen.
Yeah, it was. That was day and night in that 40 of them, because they come in at night also. And you just lose so much sleep till you got where you didn't even care. I mean, it didn't seem to bother you. During that time, I would see with the Commodore, we had to be prepared to take him where he needs to be taken. So whatever we'd be on standby, not have a permanent station, and we'd be handing ammunition or filling in someplace. And that's what I was doing at that time. Then later when I became a gunner, when I was out at sea, that would be a different story. I could have a permit station. But usually on them situations, in case I could take over for somebody else.
Is it safe to say that those 53 days at Okinawa were the most intense 53 days of your life?
Yes, I would say that. I grew up real fast. I know we hear more about Iwo Jima, it was sad. But Okinawa did have a lot more casualties, I think you'd combine them all together, be 270,000 lives lost, not counting wounded.
And nearly 5,000 from the Navy alone were killed at Okinawa.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was the biggest loss for the Navy in the history of the Navy there. We got hit by a kamikaze, and I thought that was it. This was in the evening of April the 2nd, and I was way down in our compartment, which is the bottom of the ship. And all at once, there's this big explosion. At that time, you went up on starboard and down on port. There's 50 of us down there, maybe. We got out of there okay. And I was wanting to get topside. I don't know where we're sinking or what have you. And one day, I'll just tell you about a good buddy of mine. I went through the gallery, and he had been up on the bridge, and he was all soaked with water and everything, and he had done lost it. He was plumb gone. I mean, he was so scared. He was, and I talked to him a little bit, and I had to get. I hadn't seen daylight yet. I want to get out of where I, you know, I don't know where we're going down or what, and I finally I had to leave him, and he just went over in a corner and got down in the fetal position. He couldn't help himself or nothing. If we went down, he'd have went down. And I went up topside, and now scattered around on the deck was pieces of body and bodies and planes all over the deck. I'm standing there because this day I'm just a standby for. And well, I look over at our sister ship, which is the Henrico, the APA 45. It just got hit, and it was burning dead in the water, and killed lots of sailors. I looked up, and here come these. This days we got hit, but with bombers called Francis. Not fighters, but they were bombers. I looked up, here come a bomber off over our port side, and it was just getting ready to come down on us because it wasn't flying very high. And all at once, that plane was coming, and it made a turn. And I looked up the belly of that plane, and it went out and got our escort. Just blew, you know, it got, instead of us, it got that. And, I mean, I just turned around and looked up to straight ahead, and about 5 degrees off of the starboard side, I seen another plane coming in. And it was maybe 200 feet above the water. I waited there, and I said, well, I waited so long, I said, well, now, this is it. This is, I'm not going to survive this. It's too close. I can't shoot it down. So I just jumped back down the deck, down in the galley, made about one step down jumped. And waited for it to happen. Thought that was it. Now, it didn't blow, and I went topside, and they got it with a 5-inch on. And I found out 55 years later, talked to the guy, put high sights on that thing, and got it. And so we shot that one down. Then, another minute went by, and I looked over on the starboard side, coming straight in was another bomber. And it was I was just trying to guess the distance from us. If I said 300 yards, I mean, it's coming 200 miles an hour maybe. And it's just ready to make it to hit us. And we shot the left wing off. And it stalled in the air. And I looked at that pilot. I don't know where he shoved that window forward or back and jumped out. Just jumped out in the ocean before it crashed. And it hit right at the edge of our ship. And... So anyhow, that was that one day, but there's a lot of other ones.
So I mean, as I hear you describing this, I'm just trying to picture it in my mind, and it almost seems like these Japanese planes, which are not trying to bomb you, they're trying to crash into you and take you out. That they're just swarming around like flies or something.
They did bomb us first. I mean, this one had hit us. I don't know why he dropped 2 500-pound bombs. Just missed us. If he had kept them bombs, we'd have probably went down. And the way I understand what happened there, if you take weight out of a plane, it'd naturally go up, and it hit us high, you know, instead of down maybe where he really wanted to hit us. We'll never know why that happened. But
well, I bet you have your theories on why and how, and it sounds like each one of those you thought could have been it, was probably going to have been it, and none of them were it. Why do you think that is?
Well, I just give God the credit there myself, personally. I really do.
And that has been a familiar refrain from those that survived the Battle of Okinawa and the intensity of kamikaze attacks right from the get-go on Easter Sunday, 1945. For Seth Irving, who had joined the Navy from the Oglala Lakota Reservation in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, the baptism by fire actually began before Easter aboard the destroyer USS Newcomb.
Now, we went to Okinawa about 3-4 days and bombarded, and then the Marines came and Army came and landed. Then we went on picket duty, they call it. All the destroyers were lined up around, kind of half circle around the island, and we were on the northernmost part of that circle. April 6, 1945, approximately 4:35 o'clock, we got a report that over 500 kamikaze planes were leaving Japan.
And you still weren't scared?
No, we got prepared to fight.
Holy moly.
Yeah. And then, you know, we had a lot of aircraft carriers around. They released their and they shot down approximately half of them, or a little over half. Mm-hmm. So there was only about 200 or something got through into the ship area, and that's when we got into it.
So you're on your 40-millimeter mount.
I was on my 40-millimeter mount, but I wasn't firing on anybody because my ship must have been going east. The planes came from the north. Mm-hmm. And so the port side man, he was firing on them, but we were at a standstill because there was nothing coming past.
So you're just sitting there waiting to get something to shoot at.
Sitting there waiting for somebody to tell us there's a plane here or there. But the first kamikaze that broke through, I had a rangefinder. He was on the phone with the control who told him where the planes were, and he would set the range on that gun sight, and he's the one that told me, he said, hit the deck, Seth, there's the plane coming. So I don't know how I did it. I unhooked, and I didn't hit the deck. By that time, it blew me into the water.
You didn't hit the deck because the plane hit your ship before you had a chance to hit the deck.
Yes. All I could see was planes coming. That's all I remember anyway. Mm-hmm. I must have lost it, but I wound up in the water.
So the impact of this kamikaze on your ship blew you right into the water.
Yeah.
It means the ship hit, the plane hit pretty close to where you were.
Yeah, it hit about the middle of the stack. And the stack that I was on threw me and bent over, and I guess that's what happened to me. But that rangefinder didn't make it.
A lot of guys didn't make it.
Yeah. No, I had a 10-man gun crew. I was the only survivor on that gun crew. Of the other gun crew, there was only one survivor off of that one. I was firing at it. And then after I got into the water, the propeller must have missed me by 2-3 feet.
So you're in the water, you're conscious, you're burnt, well, and this propeller is flying right at you? The propeller from the plane, or are you talking about?
Look, our propeller.
Your
the
ship. You almost got caught in the screws of the destroyer.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I must have been underwater because I could hear it just mumble. And I came up, and that screw, you know, was pushing the water, and it just pushed me out of the way.
Wow.
It pushed me about 100 feet or more away from the ship.
I'm sure you're still pretty stunned and dazed, but how much pain were you in?
I don't remember being in any pain. All I know is that when I was strapped in, I had a steel helmet on, I had a capot jacket on, and all of my clothes were gone. I was bare.
You were naked in the water?
Yeah. I didn't have no shoes. I was burned from my hair was all burned off to about my knee, all on the front side, you know.
So the explosion blew all your clothes off, your helmet off, burnt all your hair off, and burnt you from head to knee.
Yeah.
But you weren't in pain.
I don't feel pain. I don't know why. I just didn't feel pain.
What went through your mind when you realized what kind of condition you were in?
Survival, I guess. That's when survival takes over. I was in that water from about 4:30 until about 10 o'clock at night. Now, that was the scariest part because you start getting scared, you know.
Well, yeah.
Because of the sharks, etc. I was really scared. And during that period from about 4:30, 5 o'clock, there was a burnt life raft came floating by, and I jumped onto it. I thought I was going to get saved, but there was nothing on there. It was just burnt. And I was riding it along like that in the ship, and in maybe 2-3 hours, and it was getting dark, and I saw a silhouette of a destroyer sitting there, and I noticed that I was going to miss it by floating, you know.
Yeah, you're floating on this raft, and it's going to take you away from the destroyer.
Yeah. So I abandoned the raft. I figured even though that ship probably couldn't pick me up because they're still under attack, you know.
Yeah, it's not like you can hit the timeout button, come pick me up. They're still fighting each other.
Yeah, and so I was just about ready to get to that ship, and it took off. Of course, on that water, it just pushed me back out of the way. And there I was with nothing, just swimming by myself. I didn't have nothing on me.
So you're naked, you're burnt, you've already been in the water for 3 hours, and now your chance at survival just
vanished,
went away from you.
Yeah.
Did you think you were going to die in that moment?
Yes, I did. I figured I don't think I could make it till morning.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you hear stories about ships and survivors on life rafts for 4 or 5 days, some weeks, some. But I didn't think I was going to make it. Then it was pitch dark, and then I was floating, and it was dark, and all of a sudden I saw a flicker of light, just barely saw it. I started screaming, you know. That light came right up to me, and they picked me up around 10 o'clock at night. And, of course, they gave me morphine and put me out within a half an hour, within 15 minutes while I was aboard that ship. I got up by the ship, and guys came down on a
rope ladder?
Yeah.
To get you?
To get me. And they grabbed my hand like that, and that slipped, fell back into the water.
Did they just pull the skin off your arms?
Yeah.
Oh, ouch.
I was burned, you know. I didn't realize it either.
They didn't realize it either?
No, they didn't know it, you know. The next group came down, they raised me up out of there.
That had to be painful, were you still kind of numb or in shock? Huh?
I must have been in shock because I don't even remember pain. All I remember, I was saved. I know that within 15 minutes, I was treated, you know. Whatever they did was right. The next morning, that ship transferred me over to a transport that was transporting troops.
Uh-huh.
Was converted to a hospital ship,
mm-hmm.
and I was transferred to it.
You mentioned when you first found yourself in the water and took stock of the situation that you were concerned about sharks, about, you know, the enemy that was still firing away.
Yeah.
Did you see any sharks during those 6 hours?
Nope.
Good thing.
No. And another strange thing is I didn't see another body.
Nothing.
Nothing. I don't know if that propeller caught me alone and sent me out that way.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I looked and looked and looked because I was wanting to be picked up right away, you know.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, but I didn't see a soul. I was out there for them 6 hours alone.
6 hours?
Yeah.
How long did it feel like?
Lifetime, really. Oh, howdy.
I've talked to some guys who've been in similar situations in the water for a long time. And some guys will describe doing things to keep their mind occupied or thinking through different scenarios. Or some guys would say a prayer. They'd frantically, you know, try to get someone else's attention. What did you do? How did you pass that time?
I don't remember.
I mean, mentally, what was going through your mind? Were you saying a prayer? Were you saying, I'm going to make it? I know I can? I mean, how did you keep going? Where did you find that hope and that persistence to power through?
All I know is I had to survive, you know.
Yeah.
And I did whatever I could. I never saw a shark, and I never saw another human being in there. That burnt wrap was the only thing that I saw, and I should have stuck to it, but I didn't.
Well, what do you think would have happened to you if that raft didn't float by?
I probably would have died. I probably would have let myself die. I was never a good swimmer, but I stayed afloat.
And that 3 hours made a big difference, I'm sure, to have that raft.
Yeah.
Another question that comes to mind. Sorry for all my crazy questions. But you said something when that kamikaze hit. And again, you got the word that something was coming. And just before it hits, you unbuckle. If you did not unstrap yourself from that position, what do you think would have happened?
I would have been drowned. Because I think that, although that guy told me to unbuckle, and I did, and he didn't, because he didn't survive.
He probably didn't have time.
He must have not unbuckled.
Yeah.
And went down with the...
So the whole gun mount went into the water.
Yeah.
So you would have been trapped, if not killed by the impact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or else drowned.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how far down it went. But I know I didn't go very far in because I came up and I just threw some salt water out. But it wasn't that much. So I must have just went in and out, you know.
And just the fact that of your 10-man crew, you were the only one to survive and that the other gun crew had the same ratio. I mean, that in itself says you beat some pretty significant odds to survive.
Boy, hardly we did. Well.
How do you explain it?
I have no answer to that, because 84 of my shipmates died that evening amidships. All those torpedo men, they were right in that, and that stack was above a engine room.
Yeah.
And it blew. That was engine room number two. That blew the same time I got it. And all those guys didn't survive. There were some survivors. Of course, the first plane got me.
Yeah.
But there was four other planes hit that ship.
Five kamikazes on one destroyer.
Yes.
But it didn't sink.
It didn't sink.
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
We could probably fill the rest of your holiday weekend with the amazing stories we've heard about Easter 1945 over the years on Hometown Heroes. But when we come back, it wasn't just Okinawa. Some memories from the European theater are just as gripping. And we'll get a taste of that when this special holiday edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special edition on Easter weekend 2024. We've heard some World War II Passover stories over the years here too, but this year Passover doesn't fall until late April, so we're focusing on how World War II veterans experienced the final Easter of that global conflict. We've already heard from a couple men who came close to losing their lives in kamikaze attacks in the Battle of Okinawa, which started on Easter Sunday and lasted 82 days, claiming the lives of more than 12,000 Americans. But it wasn't a picnic in the European theater either. For an 18-year-old from Grand Rapids, Michigan, with the 86th Infantry Division named Bill Koning, it marked his first real combat experience.
I was the so-called first scout in the 3rd Squad of the 2nd Platoon of I Company of the 341st Regiment and 86th Infantry Division.
Uh-huh.
And so as first scout, you're supposed to see them before they see you.
Yeah.
But landing in Le Havre, cold, we went to a bar on the Rhine River, and the whole group was, they just walk into these places and you take over. And so this bar had a beautiful patio out looking over the Rhine. There was a normal infantry squad had maybe, was supposed to be 12, we had maybe 10, 9 guys. Look out and see Germans on the other side, very small things going past on bicycles once in a while. And so we were just sitting there. And along about the 1st of April was Easter, and they asked for volunteers to a patrol to go across the Rhine River and pick up a person, find somebody that knew what outfit was over there. Now, why they had to know the name of the German outfit, I don't know, but we were supposed to get a German prisoner and bring him back with us.
That sounds like a pretty mundane mission, no big deal.
No big deal. You know, it starts at the battalion, it comes bouncing, and finally it's our platoon. The platoon leader volunteered for it. And so then it's now who in the platoon is going to go. And so they ask for volunteers, and my squad leader, who I admired very much, volunteered, so I volunteered. Jim Karakoff from Norfolk volunteered. He was our BAR man. And our assistant squad leader volunteered. So that was 1, 2, 3 out of that squad. And there was another one out of the first squad, just a regular infantryman, and another one out of the third platoon who volunteered. And so you got the leadership of the second platoon pretty well taken care of, at least the third squad taken care of. And so there were like 5 of this infantrymen and 3 engineers. And I can remember standing on the, they had a boat ramp going down to the Rhine River, and stand there and look around. There's just a dozen, about 10 of us. And you think about that. Maybe I'm not coming back. That's when it hit me.
That's the first time you thought that?
Yeah.
I can see why.
It's the first exposure, really, to anything. And so it's the 1st of April, and it's Easter Sunday. So they say, let's go. And so we run down to the boat ramp, hop in the boat. Motor won't start. Quick, get the paddle. We get the paddles out. We paddle across. Just before we get to the other side, a machine gun burst comes through the boat. I don't know how he missed as much as he did, but he did hit my squad leader. And I look down, and here's Cowboy Letro. Cowboy is his nickname. Lying in the bottom of the boat, his face all blood. And so we get to the other side, and we hop out. We run up the bank, and there was a big church wall. Oh, maybe 30 feet high, big church wall. And just as we get ready to go into the town, which was a little path going into the town, another burst of that machine gun comes through and takes out the assistant squad leader. And so now we've lost 2 already. And I quickly jumped into a hole that eddy that the spring thaw had made in the bottom there. And Kirchhoff, the BAR man, jumped right on top of me. He landed on my back. He said, oh, just like the best hotel in town. And so we're stuck in this little hole in the ground. And I'm looking right up a boat ramp into the town. So I stick my head up to see what's going to happen. And I take a little ding on the top of my head, and the machine gunner's gone again. So I duck back down into the hole. And I pick up my gun, and I was using a friend's gun. It was a BAR, an automatic rifle. And I put it over the edge of the hole because I'm going to fight back. I pull the trigger, and it's supposed to go brrrr. It went pop. Dumb thing won't work. Mm-hmm. 1 shot at a time instead of automatic. So about this time, the lieutenant says, this isn't going to work. We better go back. So we jump up and go back. And so now we left 1 man there, the assistant squad leader. He was killed. And the rest of us run back in the boat, paddle back across the Rhine River. And when we land, the Germans now have got big artillery. And boy, they start shooting at that spot where we landed. That's the first cannon exposure we had. And boy, he was accurate as all get out. Now, I don't know how much damage he did to anybody else, but our group survived. But it was just a real touch and go there, artillery like you wouldn't believe. So we knew what war was all about.
I guess so. I didn't want to interrupt you in any of that, but I do have a few questions. You say your assistant squad leader was killed, and it was your squad leader who was hit before that in the boat?
That's right.
But he survived?
Yes, he survived. The bullet went in his mouth. I saw him after the war. Took out 2 teeth, went all the way down his neck, through his shoulder, and they took it out of his arm where you have your, what they call them, angel wings or something.
Yeah.
Took it out way down in his, halfway to his elbow.
Wow.
He survived, became a refrigeration repairman in Tennessee.
Wow. But you're exposed right here. This is your first real taste of combat, and
yep,
you're already seeing one guy you said you really admired almost killed, another guy in your squad killed, and you mentioned a ding on top of your helmet. Now, that wasn't someone with a little mallet playing with you.
He was shooting at me.
That was a machine gun bullet,
yes,
that hit your helmet.
Yes.
But fortunately at the right angle that it didn't penetrate.
That far from the bottom of the helmet, so by 2 inches lower, he would have had me.
But it didn't even, it just bounced right off.
Bounced off.
Is that something that got your attention at the time, or is that one that that night later on you're thinking, boy,
it got my attention. I kept my head down from then on.
Yeah, that's a little too close for comfort. So you guys had gone over to try to determine which German unit was there,
yeah,
grab a prisoner.
Yeah.
You realized, we're not going to get a prisoner. We got to get out of here or else we're going to be dead.
Yeah, the lieutenant realized that.
Uh-huh. And then when you got back to your side, their artillery was zeroed in on you. So what does that mean? Their shells going off right by you?
Yeah, they had us pretty well zeroed in. So you get down on the ground and you sweat it out. A friend, a guy from another part of the platoon, when we landed, we knew they could see we had a wounded person aboard. And so this, you're on the edge of a river now. And just up the river, there was a cultivated field. And we hollered for the medic. And the guy that the Jeep driver in our company came bouncing across the field, and it's under heavy fire now. He volunteered and came bouncing across that field to get to Cali, pick him up. And they, fortunately, they gave him a Silver Star for it.
Well, they should. Yeah. He risked his life to save another.
Yeah.
But I'm still thinking about you being a 19-year-old kid. You're keeping your head down. You're ducking. But there's nothing you can do to stop that artillery from hitting you. If it lands on you, you're gone.
You're done.
So what are you doing with your head down? Are your eyes closed? Are you saying a prayer? Are you just gritting your teeth? What are you doing?
I don't recall any particular thoughts other than get as low as you can get. Get everything but your heels and your helmet. I don't have any thought now. Later on, we had more exposure to that sort of thing and mortar fire and all that. And got caught once in the middle of the street. And this is no, first off, I said my squad leader got hit and the insistent squad leader got killed. They suddenly made me the squad leader. And here's a 19-year-old kid, the squad leader. Never done anything like that before in my life. And I got 6-8 guys reporting to me.
Yeah.
Now, the group gets these 3 new people coming in, replacements, because we were down and we lost 2, and we were only about 8 to begin with. Mm-hmm. And the 3 are very, you remember them. One that was a 33-year-old Boston man, wife and 3 kids at home, and later on he got killed. Mm. One, he stuck real close to me all the time. And finally, one night, we were sitting outside somewhere on guard duty outside some farmhouse, black as night, couldn't see the end of your gun. And he just, I felt him shaking. I said, "What's the matter, Pat?" He says, "I'm scared." I said, "Well, I am too." He said, "Yeah, but I'm only 15. And so Pat went home the next day.
You ratted him out, or he ratted himself out?
No, we ratted him out. We got rid of him quick.
Wow.
And everybody cooperated in getting rid of him because 15-year-old kid don't belong out there.
Yeah, and he had obviously lied
about
his age.
So now that's another guy out of my group. So now I'm a squad leader that's supposed to have 12 people, and we got about 7 left now.
Oof.
And so from then on, when I talked to my friends, I still talked to one guy. We had it easy. We surely did. Our job was, occasionally we were in the front line, but it was never that much exposure. The war was just about over. It's my 1st of April, the war's over the 1st of May. So let's say we had 6 weeks of combat. Yeah, we walked and rode. We ride all night in trucks and walk all day. And we were cleaning out places. We were getting rid of people out of houses. We'd kick people out of houses because we didn't want to leave anybody behind us.
Sure.
As you go through. So we really... Never were we, again, in a position where it was boom, 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 and we could see who we were shooting at. And most of us never even had to shoot anyone because we were clearing houses.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exposed to fire. I can remember crossing bridge one time and a mortar shell plopped in the mud right next to the bank.
Didn't go off?
Didn't go off.
Wow.
It hit the mud. Just went... But, you know, it was walk all day, ride all night, walk all day, ride all night. I've got 6 guys reporting to me, 7, 8. You mentioned, what do you do when you're in the middle of the street and you get caught? You lay down and you sweat. Or you stand and get down in a doorway somewhere. This one particular incident where I was just 2-3 days out there someplace, and one guy said, "Hey, Conan, go out, Sergeant, go over there, Wally, something's the matter with Wally." So I look around, here's Wally laying in the middle of the street, shaking like a leaf. I run up to him, he says, "If I get out of this alive, my kid's going to Sunday school every Sunday. If I get out of this alive, my kid's going to Sunday school every Sunday." So this 19-year-old philosopher that I am, you know, with all this training I've had, I say, "Here, have a cigarette." I had to get him calmed down and get him out of the middle of the street.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just funny stories like that that come back and haunt you.
And what was it, do you think, that enabled you to avoid those moments of panic where it's just so consuming that these guys couldn't function and couldn't move on?
I don't know. You survive. You look for a place to survive is what you do. Mm-hmm. And so I say you get down next to the curb. That's all that's there. You get a chance then when it's not something coming at you, you quit getting to the doorway of the house next door. or a hole that you see someplace next to it. If you're in the country, it's down in a ditch.
You mentioned that mortar shell that lands in the mud next to you. I don't want to assume something that's not true, but it sounds like had that mud been a little harder, you wouldn't be here.
It would have gone off, yeah.
And it would have killed you.
Yeah, but I realize that now, but then I'm lucky.
Yeah, no big deal.
It spurred me on. I ran a little bit faster.
How exhausting was it?
That's one of the things that I want to talk to you later about some other thing, but that's sure. One of the things is you're dead tired all the time. And so when you go to sleep, you sleep. And if the sleep is 2 hours or 6 hours, you're sleeping. Mm-hmm. And you've never been so tired as you are. And yet you can run just as fast as you ever run. And you can get around you can yell and everything else just as fast. You've got a lot of junk hanging on you. You know, you got food and canteen and all that stuff. But you can get it out of the way to run. You're invincible. You're only 19 years old.
That never wavered for you, huh?
No.
All right.
You know where you go for everywhere. You worry about your own protection. You worry about your guy's protection. You look at the ditch. You make sure you got a spot to jump to. But you don't worry it's ever going to hit you. You don't do that. I take pride in being a soldier in World War II. I do take pride. I stand straight on that. I was lucky, very fortunate. And if I really want to get mundane about it, I can say I was saved to do something. But I can, I have had a very good life, had four beautiful children, wonderful wife, went to school, got an education, ran food plants for General Foods all around the country. And so, that was my want in life. I'm very proud of what I did. Yeah, from that standpoint.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. Is that something you think God was protecting you?
Yes. Very definitely. He had something planned. He usually doesn't tell you what he's going to do.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, a story that's sure to add a little perspective as you gather with your family for a holiday feast this weekend. What if you had to spend Easter in a prisoner of war camp? For those who celebrate it, this particular holiday is all about hope and freedom. And you may see those two words in a whole new way after hearing this next account. Our special Easter weekend edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, concluding our special Easter weekend edition of the program with a story that still gives me goosebumps more than a decade after I first heard it.
In a few minutes, we're going to hear about where Glenn Schmidt did his praying on Easter Sunday, 1945, and how quickly the amazing answer to that prayer materialized. But to set it up, he was captured in a pillbox near Hattin, Germany, after obeying an order to hold at all costs and maintaining that position against all odds for more than 2 days. His helmet wouldn't fit on his head anymore because of a couple of holes a German machine gun bullet had left in it. And shortly before all that unfolded, a letter from back home in California had reached this 42nd Infantry Division soldier.
It's the only letter I can remember, what in all the time that I was over there, that I had received from my father. And my father was not a writer of letters, I can tell you that. He wrote a portion of the 91st Psalm, the 7th verse, where it says, "A thousand shall fall at thy side, 10,000 at thy right hand, and it shall not come nigh thee." After I read that letter and we were told to go out on this patrol, I asked the fellows to take off their helmets and bow in a moment of a prayer, which we did. I'm so thankful I did at that time because, like I say, or have told, there are some that did not survive.
And obviously that's something that stuck with you and something that really proved true. As they died all around you, you found a way to survive. I know the journey to the prisoner of war camp is a story in itself. I want to get to the conditions inside the camp, but just getting to it was pretty harrowing. Not only are you being marched and taken on trains and transported this way or that, at one point you had a very real fear that you could be killed by your own troops who were firing at your position.
The night we were captured, we were taken to a little town by the name of Buell, lined up in the street, and our artillery was zeroing in on this little village. The church was on fire, and they're trying to set more buildings on fire with white phosphorus shells. And at that time, in two groups, we were separated maybe 20 feet, and an artillery shell came in, landed on that street between our two groups, ricocheted through the fence, and did not explode. Now, that's a miracle in itself.
And it wouldn't have bothered the Germans a whole lot if you guys had been killed.
No, sir.
Obviously, they were leaving you out there for that possibility.
It could have been.
So again, somebody's looking out for you. Then you get to the prisoner of war camp. And you had gone in, you described carrying around your BAR equipment, and you were strapping 145 pounds. Did you realize after you'd been captured that this starvation was going to set in? Did you realize that you would be so malnourished and fed so little?
Not at all. We had no idea. The Germans told us that the war was over for us and we could relax. But the day we walked into camp, there were approximately 100 of us, and I was up in front of the group because I had been in front of the group for some time without going into that part of the story. A German guard standing at the gate in good English says, "You will live from 5 to 7 months on what you get to eat here." Those weren't very encouraging words. The fellows behind us wanted to know what he said, and none of us would repeat it. But it proved to be quite true.
Well, and of course, at this point, nobody knows when the war is going to end. It's an uncertain future. You don't know what tomorrow is going to hold, but
that's
that
true.
Is certainly unnerving. And then, as you said, it was proven true with the diet that you got. You hear about prisoner of war camps and aid parcels that show up. That didn't happen very often at Stalag 9B, did it?
No, sir. No. In the morning, they brought up, fellas went down to what we called a kitchen and brought up a barrel of ersatz coffee. It was just maybe a little chicory in it. We don't know. It had some color, and that's about it. Most of the fellas just washed in it. I drank it because I wanted something warm inside of me because there's still snow on the ground all over. We were up on a mountaintop southeast of Frankfurt, about 30 miles.
And as far as food, not much of anything. Some bread with a lot of sawdust in it,
yes,
probably?
Yes. In the evening, a loaf of bread was handed to us to be divided between not less than six, mostly 10 to 12 fellas. I used my pocket knife. It was to be divided among six men or whatever. A group was chosen up, and I handed my pocket knife to him, and he cut it up as evenly as he could. The fellow who cut the bread got the last piece.
Mm-hmm.
So you know he cut it as close as he could.
And I have a surprise guest joining us on the line from Wichita, Kansas, is Dr. Bill Paschal, who, like Glenn, was a prisoner at Stalag 9B in Bad Orb, Germany, during World War II. And these two did not know each other at the time, at least not by name. But Dr. Paschal, can you tell us quickly how you became aware of this gentleman named Glenn Schmidt and the powerful first impression that he made on you?
Yes, I sure can, Paul. Glenn is actually a lifesaver. We were in the prison camp, Bad Orb, Germany, and things were pretty grim. We'd witnessed some brutality to our man of confidence. We had been lined up in the yard with the guards facing us with machine guns. The food was almost non-existent. Recreation facilities were nothing. The building that we were in was a thin board roof and upper part of the walls. When it snowed outside, it snowed inside. And actually, a lot of the men in this building that I was in, there were 3,000 Americans, but there were 300 men in the barracks I was in. A lot of the men gave up hope, and they thought that it was a question of not when they would get liberated, but how long they could survive in this environment. Some of these men turned their face to the wall and didn't communicate with the rest of us. They kind of daydreamed the day away, and sure enough, they became the first to pass away or die. One night, there was a big, strong voice came out and said, "I shall recite to you the 23rd Psalm," and this voice began to do that. There was quite a few, non-believers in the crowd. There was quite a few boos and catcalls, but this strong voice recited the 23rd Psalm and some other things from the New Testament, sang some songs, and as it was almost like a miracle, that barracks became very, very quiet and attentive. You could hear a pin drop. This voice kept this up night after night. And so the lights were out. 300 men crowded there. I couldn't put a face to it. During the daytime, I spent 3 or 4 days. I wandered through the crowd of people that were in our barracks, talking to different people, and I would excuse myself and go on and talk to another person. Finally, I located the owner of that voice, and that was Glenn Smith of the 42nd Infantry Division.
And he's sitting here right now, and he just heard everything you said. And he's got a little water in his eyes after hearing it. Dr. Pascoe, thank you. I know Glenn wouldn't have told us that story himself. Thank you for coming on and sharing it. Thank you for serving our country. And if you're up for it, I'd like to have you on for a full program one of these days.
Okay, that's fine. You bet.
Anything? God bless you, Bill.
You bet, Glenn.
So good to hear from you.
Yes.
I know you two share a very special bond. And,
yes, we do.
And I'll be back in touch with you, Dr. Pascoe. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay, you bet.
All right, that's Bill Pascoe from Wichita, Kansas, surprising Glenn Schmidt with that little story. And I know for you at home, that probably grabbed your attention the way it grabbed mine. Glenn, I think the question everyone asks is, why? What possessed you to take that kind of role and try to encourage all these other men? Why? What made that possible, and why did you do that?
Well, it was a period of desperation for us all. And I felt that if we didn't group together and try to hold the line ourselves, we would see the end like many others did. I'm just grateful to my Heavenly Father for giving me the inspiration to do that. Yeah, it's nothing in me. It's God alone.
And when the Germans took you captive, you left your helmet behind in that pillbox, but they let you take three things?
Yes, my pocket knife, my wedding ring, and my New Testament. And that New Testament went around our barracks from every day. We had Bible study. We had prayer time together. And I'm so thankful for it.
And obviously, from what we heard from Dr. Pascoe, there are a lot of other POWs who are pretty thankful for it, too. Now, you're slowly starving to death. You have no idea when liberation is going to come. When it did come, how great of a day was that for you? And did you have enough energy to even enjoy it?
At that time, I was so weak, I had to crawl across the floor, pull myself up either against the wall or against a pillar supporting the building in order to stand. And it was very difficult to walk at that time. The day before, which was Easter Sunday, 1st of April, 1945, some of us went outside. I asked the fellows if they'd like to go out for a little time of prayer, which we did. We heard machine gun fire coming up out of the valley below us, and we went back into the barracks that night, not knowing that all the guards were going to either leave or surrender the next day.
Was it almost too good to be true?
Yes, it was. It was a day of not only liberation, but a day of elation. The motto of the ex-prisoners of war is, "Freedom is not free." I see that even today. There are men giving their lives for their country. We always have. Throughout, when men are called upon, men and women today, are called upon to sacrifice for their country, they seem to do it willingly. That price that they pay is the ultimate price that anyone could pay with their life. I am deeply gratified for my God and my country.
The late Glenn Schmidt, with a memory that frames up this weekend way more clearly and powerfully than I ever could. That is all the time we have today, but thank you so much for listening. If Easter is a holiday you celebrate in your family, I hope that the hope it symbolizes surrounds you and yours this weekend. And maybe there's even another level of significance for you when I share those four words we conclude with each and every week on Hometown Heroes. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.